In this era of grave spiritual crisis, it is not enough to simply know about your Catholic faith. That is why we need a Catholic toolbox to equip us with the practical skills necessary to live our Catholic faith to reach our ultimate goal, which is heaven for all eternity. Do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. Join us every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. for the Catholic Toolbox as we hand you the tools to go forth, live the faith, and change our modern world today. Live on the Voice of Charity. Back to another week on the Catholic Toolbox, the art of practical Catholicism. I'm your host and founder, George Manassa, here on the exclusive Catholic Toolbox podcast, as we equip you with practical solutions to live your Catholic faith in our modern world today. We're joined by a very special guest and somebody which I've very much followed over the years, Michael Voris. Welcome.
Hello, George. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you very much for being with me. I mean, especially during this time of COVID-19, I mean, a lot of people have been isolated all around the world and everybody's starting to think a little bit differently. People are starting to spend time with their families a little bit more. People are starting to appreciate the Mass, especially us as practicing Catholics. I mean, sometimes, you know, you slack off when you go to Mass, you slack off with your prayer, but now we're actually, I feel as if people are starting to have a renewed sense of commitment. And hopefully that's the case. And look, we're here to discuss this week, specifically the church militant restoring the church back to its former glory and sort of what led to the crisis that we're actually in. What's the underlying pin? Because we need to actually identify these things in order to take action, in order to restore the faith. So a bit about you personally, tell us a bit about yourself and how you came to establish church militant. And what was back then St. Michael's Media and then became Church Militant. Tell us a bit about yourself as well, personally.
Sure, George. I was raised in the faith as Catholic. My mother was Irish Catholic. My dad was a convert from Nazarene. He actually studied to be a Protestant minister for, I believe it was 3 years. And he just sort of threw the towel in on that and went and joined the U.S. Air Force. His first assignment was over in England. He met my mom in the 1950s, and here I am. I was raised in the faith. You know, I was an altar boy, all that business and everything. I went to a university.
Where did you grow up?
When did I grow up?
Yeah. No, sorry. Where did you grow up?
Sorry. You talk funny.
With the Australian accent.
I love the Australian accent. It's just so cool. I love it. Since I was kind of an Air Force brat, I spent roughly the first 7 years in England, then about a little less than 7 years, 6 years, sorry, in Texas. Came back there for another assignment. My dad had an Air Force base in Wichita Falls, Texas. And then we moved to California, Northern California, very, very close to Napa Valley. I just say Napa Valley because it's kind of an identifier that people know. And from there, I went up to stay there for 6 years, and then went to high school. I went to high school there and then went to college at a university, Notre Dame. Pretty world-famous university, I suppose, but, you know, very big here in the States. And I got there and, you know, I got caught up in kind of the college life and all of that business and everything.
As you do. When people grow up, they go to college.
As you do. Yeah. There were certainly opportunities on campus to, you know, be mature in the faith and grow in the faith and everything. But I was just more interested in parties and football games and all that business. And I guess the best way to say it would be I grew away from the faith spiritually. I never grew away from it intellectually. I always knew that whatever really? Church. Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, look, you can know something to be true and still not live according to it, but that doesn't mean because you're not living according to it, you don't know it's not true. You know it's true.
So somewhere, you sort of knew it was true, or some, it had at least some element of truth.
Oh yeah. No, I never doubted anything the church ever taught, ever. Still don't now, never did. I lived a horrible life of sin. I never doubted it then. I knew I was wrong, but I just, as I, you know, I don't know if it's a international expression, but in America, we just say sort of whistling past the graveyard. You just kind of la, 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 walk on with your life, knowing that you're doing everything wrong.
But that he
spend any time with it. You do. Good.
You do any things, you know, Michael.
Yeah. So, you know, live a horrible, you know, sinful, rotten life. And it was a great distress, great cause of distress for my folks and my mom, who was like mother's.
I believe your mom prayed for you for many years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. For
similar to the St. Augustine situation there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very much. Yeah. And she let me know it, too. And good for her. I'm not being facetious about that. I'm just, you know, she was she was very direct. Some people would say your mother doesn't have much charity, but I would say my mom had an overabundance of charity. She just happened to be clear about it, and I think that's one of the false dichotomies that actually exist right now within the church by people who want to downplay the teaching. And so, if you emphasize the teaching, they'll say, "Oh, you know, you're there's too much clarity, not enough charity," as though those two are opposed to each other. I mean, they're not opposed to each other. One is right with the other. You know, you love somebody, you tell them the truth. You don't love somebody, you don't care. Well, you let them just go drive off the cliff and say, "Oh, well, too bad."
Exactly. It's a tough love. I mean, really, your parents love you very much. I mean, that's a real proof. Sure. I mean, then let's say you do something wrong, they're going to whack your hand, they're going to teach you, impose some discipline on you. I mean, the same thing with Holy Mother Church. And absolutely grateful that your mother did pray. And so how did you come back to, tell us a bit about how, was there a pivotal point in your life where you came back to the faith, a reconversion time there?
Yeah, I guess you would call my reversion or reconversion moment would have been, it was a long moment, but it began. I was prepped for it, I suppose. My mom called me in 2001, October of 2001, and told me she'd been diagnosed with cancer and stomach cancer. And that's a very, you know, oh my gosh. And so she was only, I believe, what, 67? Yeah, 67. She was only 67 at the time. And, you know, I'm only 8 years away from that. So that doesn't seem so old all of a sudden.
You don't look at Michael.
Yeah, thank you. I'll send you the money later. Thank you. you know, that was just, you know, and it's just disturbing. I mean, anybody who's had to hear from their mother or father, you know, somebody they love, you know, they've got the big C word. It upsets Definitely. Your world a lot. But so my mom's cancer advanced, and they told her she had just a few months left to live. This is the next year in 2002. And said they just had 2 or 3 months left to live. So I told my dad, you and mom move out here to Detroit. That's where we are right now, Detroit, Michigan. You move out to Detroit and, you know, we can, you know, I can help take care of you. I had left TV News at that point and I was running my own business. I was making commercials for General Motors, big, you know, obviously car manufacturer, and I was producing commercials for them. And I couldn't leave. I mean, you know, if you own your own business, you are the business. So I had to stay here. Mom and Dad understood that. They packed everything up in 2 weeks, got out here, and I got them all set up nicely and, you know, everything taken care of, was all, you know, all the stuff that, you know, a good son would do. And then we just were sort of standing there, kind of, and it sounds horribly morbid, but another way to really say, just sort of standing there kind of waiting for your mom to die, because the doctor said she had 2 or 3 months on the outside.
And it's terminal.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you're sitting here looking at it going, well, okay, you're here in June. My birthday's in August. I thought, well, she'll probably be alive for my birthday. You know, you just think all these horrible thoughts. And yeah, I mean,
exactly. We are human. We are human. As much as we try sort of normalize things, we always think, mind does jump to those thoughts. I mean,
it's, well, it's of course it does. Yeah, and, right. it's not that the thought is horrible. It's a thought about a horrible thing. You know,
so exactly.
You're yeah. meditating on something awful and horrible. It's you just, you know, you got to face the reality of what's going on.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so my dad and I would talk, you know, with my mom in the room that, you know, after she had died, you know, how what would life be like for my dad and all that sort of stuff. And they got rid of everything in New York and moved here. So there was no going back to New York for my dad because they didn't have anything to go back to. But then my mom just kind of kept living. I mean, that was in early summer when they moved out here. She was there for my birthday. She was here for Labor Day, the beginning of September. She was here for Thanksgiving still, Christmas, New Year, her birthday the following March. I mean, it just kind of kept going. I remember saying to her one time, I mean, she was obviously sick. I mean, it was like she was up, you know, partying or anything. But I said to her one time, I said, Mom, are you sure the doctor got the diagnosis right? Because, you know, you look sick, but I mean, you don't look any worse than you did 8 months ago when you pulled in here. And, you know, you're supposed to be dead half a year ago. I mean, everything looks the same. And she goes, oh, I'm sick. She used to call me Pet. She goes, oh, I'm sick, Pet. Oh, well, I said, I know that, Mom, but I mean, it doesn't seem like anything's changed. Like you got here and then just plateaued.
Exactly.
And it just kept going. And all of a sudden the year anniversary passed with her being here. And I was like, wow, okay, well, this is great. And, you know, so I would go over and visit him. I set him up in this nice little, like home healthcare apartment setup sort of thing. And it was, you know, it was a very lovely place. And so I'd go over there and visit, you know, when I can. I had to obviously keep doing my business. I, you know, keep my livelihood going. And so I'd go over and visit when I wasn't out of town and that sort of thing. And then the moment arrived that I was off in Denver shooting a commercial, producing a commercial shoot for Hummer, Hummer vehicles, and my brother's wife called me and told me that he had just died of a heart attack, my brother. And he knocked me over the feather. He was 48 years old. He was fit as a fiddle.
You're very young.
Yeah. It's very young. They moved to Corpus Christi, Texas because he wanted to, he was like a fish in the water. He swam, loved swimming. He missed the U.S. Olympic team by like 0.001 or something back in the 70s. So he just loved swimming. I mean, he was fit. I mean, he looked like 20 years younger than what he was always. And he just, I'm like, what? I mean, it just didn't compute. It wasn't like he was this big overweight, you know, diabetic, you know, morbidly obese guy at his age. I mean, he was incredibly fit. And so I called my mom and dad back in Detroit. And I was like, that was a very difficult phone call to make. And here's your dying mother. And you're calling to tell her that her oldest son has died when she's the one who is supposed to have died. It's very, it was very,
look, I've been in those situations. It's definitely hard to break the news that, yeah, somebody's passed away. It's definitely hard. Absolutely. Especially to a mother. I mean, somebody, all parents have the idea that they would outlive their children, and it's extremely painful.
Oh, absolutely was. I told my mom the very first thing that she said on the phone, she said, Jesus, how many more crosses can you give me? I mean, it just breaks your heart to hear that. I was like, oh, you know, there's nothing you can do. And of course I'm calling, I don't know. I didn't know if I should make the phone call, you know, if I should make the phone call or should I, because I was supposed to be in Denver for a week. So, I had to have to have, you know, should I come, should I wait for a week to tell them? Should I just leave early and tell them in person? Well, it's going to take a couple of days to get everything together in Denver. So I was the head producer. So I got to get somebody else in there and rearrange. I mean, just stuff of life.
Yeah. It's too hard for you to sort of go.
Yeah. So I just said, I just better call. I mean, I was very torn. Should I call or should I not? I just said, well, I guess I should. So I did. And anyway, that was in August of 2003. And I went down because my mom and dad couldn't travel because of her condition. So I went down to my brother's funeral in Corpus Christi and went down for the funeral. And I went into the funeral home and, you know, he was laid out there. And that would be, I guess, if I had to say something, if I had to pinpoint a moment in time, that was the beginning of my conversion back to the faith, my reversion back to the faith.
You're living this extremely sinful lifestyle.
Correct.
I mean, if you've spoken about it on your Vortex episodes and all your other episodes. And this whole situation, he was the pivotal point to you coming back to the faith. And you intellectually in the background knew that Catholicism was true, but the flesh rebelled against the soul in your situation.
Spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak.
Absolutely.
I mean, everything Jesus said was true. Some just seem more true than others, and that's certainly one of them.
So I just want to know why, what happened from there? If you can just briefly summarize what happened from there and how you came back to the faith and got back on track with your life.
I was, while I was standing over my brother's body, who was in the coffin, I was running. He had like a big, thick head of blonde hair, and I was running my hands through it and everything. And I called my mom on the phone. I said, "Mom, I'm standing here over Marshall's body. Do you want me to say something, or is there something I should do for you?" And she said, "Give him a kiss, pet, and tell him that I'll see him very soon." And that was like the thunderbolt moment. I was like, good Lord. And everything that I knew about the faith that I'd been taught and I knew, and I could, you know, I won the religion awards in class in grade school and high school and all that stuff and everything. I mean, all that, you know, check all those boxes. That was me. And all of that just came kind of like flooding back in that, oh my gosh, this is true. Every bit of it, you know, it's, death's a real sober thing. That's why all the saints have those skulls sitting on their desks and in their caves and everything.
Memento mori.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so that was really it. And so I came back, I leaned over, I gave my brother a kiss on the forehead for my mom, and, you know, obviously went to the funeral and, you know, hung around there for, you know, a couple of days afterwards, came back to Detroit. And then the tone of the conversations with my parents greatly changed from there on out. My mother died 10 months later on June 15th, coming up on the anniversary now, which would be the 2004. So the, 16 years, good Lord. 16 years my mother's been dead, and it was right after she died. I mean, I went up to her coffin. I was in the room with her in the hospice. She'd moved into she'd been in hospice care for a couple of years, but she went into the hospice center run by a lovely nun, a real spitfire nun. She's lovely, Sister Giovanni. And and I was in the room with her when she died. I went to bed. My dad, his hearing was horrible, so he couldn't hear anything. So I said, "Dad, why don't you let me stay in the room? I think mom's going to die tonight. So let me stay here in the room and I'll come get you." And so I fell asleep on a little chair couch thing they had for us. And then in the sort of, I don't know, about 4:30 or so in the morning, I guess I just want to say I was awakened. I don't know what, I don't know if it was my angel, my mom's angel, I don't know, but I prayed like crazy, please do not let my mom die without me being there with her and her knowing I'm there with her. And however I was awakened, I don't know what it was, I don't know if natural causes, I heard my mom stir or something, or my angel like shook me or whatever it was, my mom's angel, get up. so I was there for the last few moments of her life. And then, you know, a couple of days later after the wake, I was kneeling at her coffin and I put my hand on top of her womb and said, "Mom, what you went through for me, you will not have gone through in vain. I'm a changed man." And that was really it. Began at my brother's coffin and ended at my mother's coffin. It was a space of about 10 months. So I didn't have a Damascus moment where, oh, and then that's it, like a light switch. Mine was like a dimmer.
I mean, that's absolutely powerful. And look, it's so important to know who you are, because often, Michael, people just perceive you as somebody who's militant and always out there fighting for the faith, and they don't really get to know you as a person and see your story and how you came back to the faith. I mean, you get a lot of bad rap. I think you're very misunderstood. And that's why in this podcast episode, I want to take the opportunity to allow people to know who you are and this is your story, and that you really do have such a humble story and powerful one for all of us to learn from. So it's sort of as if memento mori is what brought you back, the moment of death. So you're awakening about the reality of life because of the reality of death that mm-hmm. we're all going to face. And then what comes after death? The judgment. What comes after the judgment? Three locations.
Here heaven. Or here. Exactly. This one has a waiting room.
Oh, do we talk about heaven or hell these days anymore? Or?
Yeah, well, I suppose that depends on what particular circles you're in. But exactly. If you're in a Catholic circle, of course you talk about heaven or hell. That's what Jesus talked about. That's what he came here for. You know, everything exactly. else is secondary.
Absolutely. And look, we want to talk about now, after having seen your story, how we as a church, how we sort of got to the crisis that we're in and why God has allowed things to go as far as it is. I mean, 8%, depending on which country, but your average is probably 8 to 12% of Catholics go to Mass. A lot of Catholics are uncatechized and are leaving the faith. Many of them become in prominent high political positions and they actually work against the moral law. And I mean, it's sort of like we're producing Catholics here and they're going into society and they're going all levels and they're working against the faith. How do we get to this point? I'm really trying to make sense. I mean, there's so many factors to play. Some people say it's the liturgy. Some people say it's the school, Catholic schooling system. They want to blame individual ones, but I think it's everything that's collective holistically at the same time that's been reduced. But what's your take on it?
Well, I guess one of the things I like to say is what I think it is not. I don't think it is any one thing. And I think a lot of people sort of, you know, look, when situations get desperate, you start resorting to desperate means. So people start casting about thinking, oh, here, you know, I'm trying to pull in this. Oh, this is the silver bullet. Oh, if we just do this. Oh, if we just do that. It's not that. The Catholic life is like this fantastic garden of all sorts of beautiful flowers and, you know, the aromas and everything going on. And you can't mow down the entire garden and then think, oh, all we have to do is plant this one flower and the garden is back. It doesn't work like that. When people have, you know, you'll hear some people, oh, it's got to bring back the Latin Mass. You're going to bring back the Latin Mass. First of all, I'm an aficionado or devotee rather of Latin Mass. When I can go to a Latin Mass, I generally do.
I mean, I go there once a month. I work, spread the Latin Mass in everywhere I go. But look, same here, definitely. But that's one aspect only.
It's one thing. Look, there has to be reverence in the liturgy. And people say, oh, well, you know, the Novus Ordo Mass, the one that most people are familiar with. Oh, the Novus Ordo Mass, oh, that's crazy. It's like, well, hold on a second. Hold on a second here. You can't tell me that if the Mass was Latin and all and Novus Ordo didn't exist anymore, that everything would be fine. That's ridiculous. Yeah. You go back to
the masses anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you go back to Vatican II, where a lot of people will pinpoint, say, oh, Vatican II, that was it right there. That's the problem right there. Well, every single person, bishop, at Vatican II was raised in the Latin Mass, baptized in the traditional church, confirmed, first communion, confession, ordained, you know, made bishop, everything in the old rites. So if that's the case, how did that fall apart? It isn't just the Latin Mass, but I am extremely sensitive to and agree that there has to be a reverence in the liturgy. How you pray is how you believe, is how you live.
Lex credendi, lex vivendi.
Absolutely. The law.
I'm very much familiar with your, with all your work.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's it. You know, you live how you pray, how you believe is how you live, et cetera. Bishop Sheen, who I'm sure you guys know, I'm a very big fan
absolutely.
Of.
Absolutely. Bolton Sheen, he's everywhere.
Bolton Sheen, he said, you know, if you don't live what you believe, you'll come to believe what you live. So that's true. So if there is, it's this collection of things. It's not one thing. It has to be constantly reinforced. You know, you have to have parents and families who believe and live the faith. You have to then take that faith when you go to Mass, for example, and share that lived experience of the faith in a reverent liturgy, in a reverent setting with other people. You know, you have to have a prayer life beyond just, you know, public prayer of the church liturgy, or if you say, you know, liturgy of the hours or morning prayer.
Exactly, yeah. You know, the divine office.
Yeah, you know, all of it, the entire fabric. This isn't just one, like, piece of fabric where you just pull one thread out and all you got to do is put that one thread back in and everything's the same. The entire fabric is destroyed. So you have to really begin knowing what the pattern was. You really got to kind of stitch back together almost from the beginning. You might have a few strands from that, but you've got to restitch together the whole thing and sort of create a
whole. Look, Michael, how do you respond to people who say, well, look, the church has endured so many different crises in its human history and it will come back. And this is just another one of those crises that we'll get through. Is there something different about this crisis? Because there's something that seems to be, when I read church history, it's always the church united, at least on a majority or a great level, against, let's say, a heresy, against a external threat, existential threat.
Yeah,
I mean, the church responding to that. But it seems to be, what seems to be different about this crisis? Let's say Pope St. Pius X, he came up with and knew and foresaw what society would become like. It's sort of prophetic. I mean, that's why
you
wrote Parsendi, Dominic Gretchis, and instituted the famous oath against modernism. So I don't know, what seems to be different about the crisis that we're in? And how did we actually get there? I mean, do we blame it on Vatican II?
No.
Do we blame it on society? Do we blame, who do we point the blame to?
I think you sort of just continue to blame a bit of a problem. I mean, ultimately you go back to the Garden of Eden, but if you're looking for something, I think you have to begin historically, this has been a relatively slow, there's been peaks, obviously, but a relatively slow decline of the church since the time of Martin Luther. You know, Freemasonry comes into existence a couple hundred years in 1717 when the two lodges, Freemasonic lodges of England, join together with an aim to, you know, destroy the church. You know, 60 years later, they've got the French Revolution going. But all of the ability to do all of that was really put in place by the Protestant revolt of the 16th century. Because what did you do? What stage was set there? It was the stage set to challenge authority on a religious level. Well, if you can begin to challenge a religious authority, and I'm not talking about an individual, I'm talking about the body of teaching. If you can call into question the truthfulness of the body of the teaching, and then the culture at large is based on that church's teaching and authority and understanding.
Yeah.
The idea, you know, kind of, whatever, it's overblown here in America, separation of church and state. But first of all, that's not a constitutional.
It's coming back a little bit. I feel like it's coming back a little bit in light of recent leadership, Michael.
Yeah, that's very true. There was a, under the Trump administration, there was a great deal of respect for things that are sacred.
Do you outright support Donald Trump?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Look, he does things and says things, I suppose, that are, I don't know, whatever. I mean, you know, are they?
Yeah, I know. You sort of watch him and you're like, yeah, well, but.
Yeah, but I mean, I if somebody, I mean, I should talk, right? I don't care what somebody's, how somebody delivers the message, exactly. as long as what they're delivering is accurate and has a.
So that it's not empty talk. I mean, see, at least what I liked when he said was the fact that he said, look, the days of empty talk are over. I mean, and you actually see some action there. I mean, I think people are sick of political, and even in the church circles, in the church world, they're sick of talk and no action, no following up. And that's part of why I was inspired to found the Catholic Toolbox, because we want to find practical solutions to then take action. I mean, whether it's living your faith personally, spiritually, taking action, let's say, with a pastoral issue in your parish, church, apostolate, or anything, we've got to come up practical, because it seems like for the past, 20, 30, 40 years, there's been a lot of nice, sweet talk, but there's no follow-up. There's no action from there. I mean, on a political and a church level as well. I mean, it's
There's this shellacking of like a surface charity, and it's not charity. Charity is a concern for the other person.
Why is it charity?
It has nothing to do with charity when you just are like nice. Oh, how are you? Oh, nice to have that, you know, and you gather in church and you sit around and you're kind of, you know, whimsically talking about airheady stuff. It's and then you walk, oh, that person's very nice. You know, you don't, you know, you have to make enemies if you're going to be a follower of Christ.
Exactly. I mean, look, I listened to, that's absolutely true. I was listening to Grant Cardone. You know, Grant Cardone, he's a famous real estate guru, but he said something very interesting. He said, I want enemies. He rejoices at the whole point of enemy, because he said, give me half the country as an enemy and I can be president of the United States.
That's true. That's true. I mean, we've got one here. No, it's very true. I mean, look, you know, if you don't, you know, my dad, God rest his soul, he died a couple of years ago. He used to say to me, you know, you don't, it doesn't matter what the list is of your friends you have with you when you die and go to your judgment before our Lord. You need to pull out the right list of enemies. That's what you need to show our Lord.
It's not about people hating you. It's about, because enemies are a litmus test.
Absolutely.
Your truth. I mean, often as a church, we get persecuted. Why have we been persecuted? Why do we have so many enemies throughout human history? I mean, because we have truth, and truth bugs people at all levels.
Absolutely, it does.
You create enemies. I mean, it just shows if, and this is where sort of Pope Francis makes a lot of sense, where he says, go out and make a mess. I mean,
well, he should know.
At least I'm interpreting it in light of continuity or something.
hermeneutics of continuity. Yes, I'm sure that's exactly what he means.
I like to interpret things in light of church tradition, and that's the right way to say it, Michael.
Yes, it's very true. I couldn't agree more. You should interpret things in light of church tradition. Everything, everyone.
Let's fast forward now to Vatican II. I mean, this is the big issue. 1962 to 1965, that's correct, yeah.
Right.
I think my mother was born in, yeah, 19, around then. So.
So was I. I was born in 1961, within a year of the beginning of the Second Vatican Council.
Absolutely, that's amazing. So, what happened after Vatican II? Is it Vatican II that's at fault, or is it the people who influenced the Parodis and the people behind the scenes who influenced Vatican II, and this sort of catalyzed the crisis that was already starting to happen from the Protestant Revolt through the 17th century through to now? We want to look at how we can sort of restore the church to its former glory, but we have to look at the crisis. We have to diagnostically analyze.
Absolutely. Yeah. Where did things go off the rails? So you can prevent it from happening again.
So we can prevent, we can learn history, and we can strategize so we can actually change, the
accommodation of Protestantism, within the church.
Filtrated the council.
The problem. Well, I mean, it's going on in the council, but it's even going on a little bit before that. You know, culturally, if you think about this here in the United States, Catholics were always a minority. You know, we have the Irish need not apply, and, you know, discrimination against if you're Catholic, and all that business. So there was this great longing on the part of what was largely dominantly an Irish Catholic church, but there were obviously an enormous portion of Polish Catholics and Italian Catholics and everything else. But the Irish were the ones, because they came over here, they could speak the language, are the ones who rose up the ranks fastest. So they kind of got to the level of bishops first and then started appointing each other. And there's still a lot of Irish heritage bishops within the hierarchy of the U.S. I mean, it's getting a smaller number, but it's still there. And there became this great desire on the part of the hierarchy all through those, you know, those years of the immigration and everything else, to just want to fit in and, you know, be accepted and all that. And really what happened is the church in America traded away the faith in order to be accepted as Americans. And America was Protestant. And so you started accommodating left and right. And Vatican II had an awful lot of that feeding into it, not just from the American dynamic, but also you know, something of the European dynamic as well. I mean, what a lot of people don't realize is that when Vatican II began, the attendance, the mass attendance rate in France was already at just 50%. So this idea that as the, you know, the church was this, you know, invincible, you know, rah, rah, moved into Vatican II and completely became anemic. The church was already on the slide down in various European countries, not in America. It was a different experience in America because, you know, you had 2,000 years of the church in, at least in many places in Europe, in complete control and dominance. It was the Catholic culture and all of that.
It was Christendom, essentially. The church state won, and the Pope basically ruled Europe and ruled kings.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's just amazing. You watch the papal coronation, just a bit of a side note, you watch the papal coronation ceremony.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a big liturgical enthusiast, and you just watch how elaborate the ceremony was. It took, I think, about 2.5-3 hours to coronate a pope. I mean, put him on the throne. I mean, you just look at that, you compare that to the ceremonial installation of the kings and queens of England, France. I mean, it's just, I think popes were meant to have an elaborate ceremony to display their power and authority and dominion over all the kings of Europe, because it was always seen, I'm not sure if it's the divine right of kings or the fact that it was seen as the Pope taking authority from God and placing it upon the head. So the authority was coming from God himself to rule over the land. And it's,
It was very much, I mean, look, when the Roman Empire fell apart in the midway through the 5th century, there was no structure. The only structure that existed was the church, the Catholic Church. So exactly. Just sort of kind of ipso facto, the Pope and the church, in this rejuvenation of Europe, the Christianization of Europe, just kind of grew up with that, certainly in the Western Empire. The Eastern Empire remained, stolidly Catholic, but of course the emperor was over there, and the Western Empire had fallen apart, and so the Catholic Church grows up, and the Western Europe becomes Catholic under essentially the leadership of the Pope, and that's how it was. I mean, the moment that the Pope placed the crown on Charlemagne's head, in Paris in the year 800 at midnight mass, it became the Pope crowned the king. The Pope crowned the state. The church crowned the state. And it was like that for 1,000 years until the Pope tried to crown Napoleon, and Napoleon got up and took the crown out of his hand and put it on his own head, saying, thanks for the last 1,000 years, but now we'll take it from here. Thanks for all you've done. And there was a, when you understand the history of all of that, that history in Europe that was so Catholic, that was never the case here in the United States. We were the drunken Irish that, you know, couldn't do anything, and the Italians were the dagos, and, you know, we were the mix, and all of you just forgetting the other losers. I mean, just how we were viewed.
We're still a baby, Michael, here in Australia.
That?
We're still a baby here.
Oh, yeah.
We're 200 years old.
Yeah, it's, so that's the cultural thing. So, you know, Catholics are feeling, you know, Catholics in Europe that go to Vatican II are feeling kind of the pluralistic society pressure, and the Catholics who come over from America to Vatican II, sort of the American contingent, are, they've World War II was less than a generation before the end of World War II. Catholics are starting to culturally come into their own. We could go to universities and all that sort of stuff now. It's kind of like a civil rights movement, I suppose you could think of it in terms of that way, with the American Catholic experience. And by the time the Vatican, Second Vatican Council rolls around, Americans are feeling pretty good, and it's like, hey, let's all get along, and, you know, all this. And, you know, when were those years? I mean, that was during the, there was kind of a, I guess you might call it sort of a euphoric belief in the world. We'd survived 2 world wars. Europe was, you know, on the verge of being rebuilt. We're in a race for space dominance, that man could conquer space. There was nothing but just these, as Winston Churchill would say, the broad sunlit uplands. There was nothing except just great euphoria and all of that. And it was really naive. It sort of discounted the idea, just left behind the idea that no matter how well you may be moving along or progressing mankind, you have an enemy. And that enemy is Satan, and he will do anything to destroy you one by one, collectively, and as a people. He hates you. You are the reason that he is eternally damned. So he has nothing to do except let his
lead it out to destroy the church, destroy souls and
the means of salvation. That's right.
Basically.
No church, no salvation, period. Exactly. And the church has to say this. Yeah, it's that absolutely. And the church has said they don't want to say this because now you move along here decades later.
Where's your charity? Where's your charity, Michael?
The charity is right there. You want to? I don't want you going to hell. Get into the church. Get into the ark. I don't want you to be lost and drowned in the flood. You get to do what you want, but I want you in the ark.
God doesn't send people to hell.
That's true. They send themselves.
Really?
Absolutely.
Okay. So how do we make sense of that? For many people listening, I mean, they've probably heard, you know, the whole hell story, the heaven and hell and the last four things. So how do they make sense of the fact that they can choose hell for themselves a little bit? Let's just shine some clarity on there.
Sure.
It's pretty powerful stuff.
Sure. No, it's look, if you live in accord with right reason, reason given to you by God, where you can make judgments of right and wrong. So that's kind of the diabolical trick, destroy the notion of right and wrong. So therefore the choice doesn't matter and has no consequences. Of course, choices have consequences. It's just common sense. Of course, I don't get to get drunk behind the wheel of a car and drive around. I can physically do it, but I'm going to kill somebody or myself and others.
Yeah.
Or go to jail, whatever. Choices have consequences. So take that and I'll just explode it onto the eternal scene. You make a lifetime of choices. And every time you make whatever choice you make, you predispose yourself to make a choice of the same type the next time around. Like smoking, for example. If you get into the habit of smoking, it's going to be easier. You don't have to. No one ever has to smoke the next cigarette. You never have to do that. But it's just easier the more you do it to continue doing it. All those bad habits we call vices. Or you can move down a road where you do one good thing and then you do another good thing. And the more good things you do, the more predisposed you are to continue doing those good things. So those we call virtues. So if you live a life that is a life of vice, you're probably going to die in that state. If you live a life that's a life of virtue, you're probably going to die in that state. This state is ordered to God. So when you die, and you die in that state of what in theology we call a state of grace, you go to where you know you should go to. You know, like things with like things.
Exactly. So it's sort of as if God's justice that he doesn't send you to heaven because you're incompatible, essentially.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you think somebody, you know, think in terms of somebody who has lived a life, they've wanted nothing to do with God. They don't necessarily hate God and they're, you know, if they had a machine gun, they'd kill him. I don't mean it like that. They don't care. They're completely indifferent. And by the way, the opposite of love is not hatred. The opposite of love is indifference. So if you are indifferent to God, you just have no love, you have no care, it's not on your radar, why would you then die and all of a sudden decide you want to be for eternity with something you gave not a care or concern about your entire life?
Exactly. So hell already started here for them. They're
absolutely
living
as heaven does here too. You can live a life apart from God. And all God does at your judgment is simply ratify what your choice was. That's it. Did you want to live a good and wholesome and, you know, whatever, and, you know, be good, charitable, kind, you know, all that stuff? Or did you want to be self-centered and running around and, you know, if you're a guy shacking up with every chick you can find and, you know, doing whatever it is you want to do and, you know, just this me. Okay, well, then you die, you get that. I mean, you know, God will give you, it's a horrible way to think about it. It sounds nice.
A better way to make sense of it. You definitely have shed some light and clarity on the subject just for our listeners, just so they can make sense. I mean, when we chuck around the word hell and this kind of thing, I'd sound a little bit clearer, but you can then definitely continue your own research. But let's go into let's now open the toolbox of the Catholic toolbox, the art of practical Catholicism. Here we like to focus on practical solutions. I mean, we really spoke about so many concepts here. we digested the underlying problem of the church, that is a series of things, a lack of catechesis,
yes,
liturgy, a whole disabandonment of the faith completely and on a social level. Mm-hmm. Now we like to find practical, so let's not take three practical tools that we can then take action with to restore the church. Where the church melted on earth, as Pope St. Pius, Venerable Pius the 12th.
Yes.
Correct me. Pius the 12th said, we are the church militant on earth. She is militant because the powers of darkness are ever restless in order to encompass her destruction. So we are described as a church militant, hence the title of your ministry. I mean, ministry.
Apostolate.
There you go. Yeah, yep. That's a better word.
Yes. Ministry is a Protestant word. It always drives me nuts when people say that. Oh, you have such a nice ministry. We don't have a ministry.
I'm waiting for that. So we need to be, there's the church militant here on earth. There's the church in waiting in purgatory, and there's the church triumphant in heaven. Our goal is to get to heaven. Here on the Catholic Toolbox, we focus, our end goal in finding practical solutions is so we can take action in order to achieve the salvation of our soul so that we can get to heaven for all eternity. What you have to recognize is how important it is to focus on the end goal. The end goal is heaven. We're not here to feed the poor for no reason. We're not here to do acts of charity and all the other side activities for no reason. We're here for the salvation of souls. Often it gets forgotten in the church. And that's why we want three practical tools. What can we do as lay people? And we'll talk about clergy later. But what can we do? Let's starting from the bottom, because not everything, as the Second Vatican Council foresaw as well, it's the time for the laity to step out. And this is why, Michael, you've done some tremendous work with Church Militant. And look, I'm stepping out here in the Catholic Toolbox in the need that we have to find and strategize practical solutions for the church and focus on that. What can we do, let's say, starting as lay people? How can we take action to restore the faith on a practical level?
I would say that here's the three.
Let's say the next 5 years. Let me give you a time limit. I want to see in the next 5 years, we can achieve a lot in 5 years if we put our minds to it. If everybody listening here takes some action, harnesses their sphere of influence. Let's say you're a parish leader, group leader. You run a podcast, a radio show, any kind of influence that you have, you can seize or gain some more influence and seize that to restore the faith and promote the faith. How can we, for the next 5 years, rewording that, take action? What are three practical things as lay people?
I think the first thing you have to do, if you aren't grounded spiritually, this becomes, you know, just some, I don't know, entertainment or something. You have to be grounded spiritually because of what it is we do. You know, what are you doing? Ultimately, you're fighting a spiritual war. You're just fighting it in the material realm. So that has to be sort of the first recognition. And the way, the first and primary way you prepare to fight spiritual war is with the number one spiritual weapon you have, which is prayer. If somebody is not a man or a woman of prayer, and I don't mean they're necessarily like on their knees 18 hours a day. For some people who have the ability to do that, that's fine. But most people don't have that. You know, they've got to go to jobs and families and whatever it is they do. But it means recognizing that the most important thing in your life is your relationship with our Lord. That's it. So how do you do that? You know, the old catechism of the church defines prayer as the raising of the heart, mind, and soul to God. Okay. That's heaven. We here are raising up every time we pray, but being in a state of prayer is what we will do in heaven. There is nothing, there's no other activity that will be going on other than the raising, and when we're there, the uniting of our heart, mind, and soul to God.
An eternal mass, basically.
Yeah, there is no other thing going on. So, you are taking your finite self and plunging it into the infinity of God. So there's no end. So you have to be as disposed as you can be to be ready to receive that. That spills over then into your life as you walk around the world in the material world. It's one of the things we do here at the Apostles, so I'm so insistent on, and nobody objects. I don't mean like I'm insisting over objections, but you know, we have never not had a place of prayer here. This Apostle's been around now for 15 years, whatever it is. And we have a beautiful chapel just around the corner over there.
Yeah, sent some videos. It looks absolutely beautiful.
That's just beautiful, beautiful, more beautiful than most parishes, actually.
I'm just going to say that.
And, you know, we begin every day in there with morning prayer and the Liturgy of the Hours, morning prayer, Christian prayer, the rosary. We stop at noon for, you know, 5-10 minutes and say Divine Mercy Chaplet and the Angelus. And then we finish up the day at 4:45 until 5 with evening prayer. And then there's, you know, all sorts of other little prayers going on just privately. We pray before we start our, you know, our work day specifically. We know the prayer. Matter of fact, so people won't think I'm lying. There it is right there. We start our little prayer to St. Joseph. And it's just, you know, make sure that we're working in the right disposition to, you know, to, you know, do the work and, you know, whatever. Because, you know, look, we're human beings. We, you know, we have good days, bad days, and all that stuff.
Exactly. So, look, as St. Jose Maria Escrivá says, we have to constantly be in the presence of God. And
absolutely.
We have to constantly be in prayer and be sanctifying our work and finding holiness in the midst of our ordinary circumstances. You guys, you have that very strong emphasis on that. And that's why it's very important. We can't do anything without prayer. So I think the first step is to take action with your prayer life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. St. Francis de Sales said, "You do the surest way to be damned is to be a channel of grace." Think about that for a second. He said, the surest way to be damned is to be a channel of grace. What's a channel of grace? Grace is just, here's the channel, and the grace just flows through it, like the water going through a pipe, but the pipe isn't converted at all. The pipe isn't turned into water because water flows through it. And he gives the examples. Judas was a channel of grace. Caiaphas was a channel of grace. Pontius Pilate was a channel of grace. They did all their evil, horrible stuff. God uses it. He doesn't like it.
Used it.
But, you know, he still supplied grace through the world. St. Francis de Sales says, you don't be saved by being a channel of grace, grace just passing through you. That's not a willful acceptance on your part. It's just God using your action. You don't get any credit for that. You didn't do anything for it. God just used your choices and affected his good with them, but you still sinned. The best way to be saved is to be a reservoir of grace where you're holding it. And then the grace fills up and doesn't leave you, but spills over from you and then affects your work. So that's the way to think about it. Don't be a channel of grace. You go to hell if you're a channel of grace. But if you're a reservoir of grace, well, there you are. And what does the angel Gabriel come to our Blessed Mother and say? Hail, full of grace, because she was the reservoir. And what happened? The author held over from her.
Absolutely. Look, I'll just quickly make a quick note for those men wanting to make their rite of passage into manhood, or if you're a woman wanting to help your fellow spouse, father, brother, friend, or whoever it may be, subscribe to my men's podcast, The Rite of Manhood, available in the Apple iTunes, Android, and other platforms, where I'll personally walk you through your journey to become and grow as a man. Check out our website and subscribe to our podcast alert on www.therightofmanhood.com for more information. So look, let's continue, Michael, on the second practical tool. How can we then, once we've become a reservoir of grace, or at least we're working towards it, we're always aspiring.
Sure. Absolutely.
What can we then do to then step out and take some action as a lay person? I mean, look, it seems like we're not in charge of anything anymore. I mean,
you need to study. You need to study and learn. You need to, and you need to do it both in the sort of the spiritual realm of, you know, studying the faith as a, you know, the 2000 years of information and the saints' teachings and scripture and mass and just fathers of the church, the doctors of the church, everything. You've got to make that a key component of what you do. It has to become you. You know, when you learn something it becomes you. I mean, it may have been written by somebody else, or it may have been, you know, you learned it in class or something, but, you know, Why am I able to do mathematics now? I'm able to do mathematics because somebody gave it to me. And having given it to me, they can never take it away from me. I can dispose of it if I want, but it's mine and it becomes me. So I don't walk around every time I, you know, punch something in a calculator, you know, 2 times 12 is 24 or something. I don't stop and think, oh, that was Mrs. Reed's in second grade who taught me how to do that. It's just me. It just becomes me. Thank God for Mrs. Reed's. You know, that's a wonderful thing she did. Thank God for Sister Rosalie and Sister Bernadette and all of them that taught me all of this. But, you know, it's now me. It's now mine. And I get to pass it on to somebody else. So there's that spiritual realm. Learn the catechism, not just what the church teaches. You have to know what the church teaches, but you also have to know why.
Start off with the catechism. That could be a good thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, we had, 2 weeks ago, I think, was it a week ago? Yeah, I had Bishop Richard Umbers. I don't know if you're aware. Mentioned that it's very important to just catechism, catechism, catechism. And look, it's sort of been simplified with Cardinal Ratzinger issuing the latest version of the catechism. I mean, it's been simplified. All the Thomistic and philosophical language that most people, unfortunately, because of the lack of Catholic readership and catechization, it's easier to understand. It's much more simple and gets straight to the point a little bit. So it's good to start off, get the latest version of the catechism and start your study. I mean, you can get it online. There's no excuses why you have to go out and get a book. It's online. It's on the Vatican website. And you can start your journey to learning your faith and start to catechize yourself. Or if you want to check out and learn a bit more, you can go to churchmilitant.com. Is that correct?
Well, that's true. Yes, churchmilitant.com. You can learn.
How many programs do you run? I want to take the opportunity to, to sort of shed some light, because often you get a bad rap because of the vortex.
I don't know why. I think the vortex is very pleasant.
I love the vortex. I think it's too
charitable. You're too charitable, Michael.
I think it's a very, just step into the vortex. It's very charitable in here. It's direct, but you know, charity and directness are the same thing.
You like to trap lies and falsehoods in that. And people just see that and think that's all Michael Voris is about. Lies and falsehoods, objecting against people. I won't go into too much detail.
Yeah. Oh, I get it. Donald Trump of the church. So somebody sent me an email and said that a couple of weeks ago. You're like the Donald Trump of the church. I'm like, well, I don't know that. But, you know.
Is it your hair?
No, mine's not yellow. It's just, it's like, these lights are deceiving. It's actually like white gray, but it comes up on these lights as like blonde or something. Like, I got to do something about that. But we're under lockdown here. I mean, if you guys know that, you know, we can't.
We're still in lockdown. Yeah. We have a three-stage plan here in the state of New South Wales.
Can't do anything. So including getting a haircut, which I can't wait for. Got off track. What were we talking about?
So it's basically the fact that we have to, we're talking about the importance of catechesis and church militant and all your activities.
Oh, right. Yeah. So we have about,
what else do you rather than the vortex?
Well, we have we have sort of two sets of programming. We have one that is more limited, that is just, you know, kind of straightforward news and that sort of thing. So if you go to the site, churchmilitant.com, you type in, up will come some news articles and or little daily video reports, 2 or 3 a day, that we put out, just covering some particular topic that happened of the day. That's what most of this room is occupied with, because news happens so fast and there's so much.
You have a news outlet as well, a Catholic news outlet, which is...
Everything's right there on churchmilitant.com. Yeah, we're a Catholic news outlet, but the...
Independently owned?
What is that?
Independently run. I mean, it's not, it's good, yes, to get. I'm always someone, I like independent advice, because often there's vested interests and agendas, even on church levels, unfortunately. And that's why you, as an independent media, I mean, that's why I definitely would.
I always still question things. I still question your media. It's always good to be questioning things, asking questions. But I at least can rest assured that what I hear sometimes is a bit more, is a bit more objective than what you might hear in the mainstream TV or other.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, you know, if you are, you know, we run this. No one else runs this. This is us. There's, you know.
No one else owns it.
Nobody else owns it. No. Nobody else. I know there's nobody standing behind the scenes, flipping $1 million in here once a year and saying, do this, do that, don't do this. Absolutely not. I actually had a number of years ago, probably 8-9 years ago, a fellow who said he was willing to give us, I can't remember what it was right now. It was a lot of money at the time, like $7,500 a month or something, which, you know, over the course of the years, that's not too shabby. And he wanted to, talk about some political type things or something. And I was like, not sure. And he wasn't really quite sure. So I said, well, okay, I kind of see where you're going. So we took a month's worth of money and started doing, stuff we were doing with it. And he called me up and said, well, I kind of like you to do this story. And I said, no, that is a purely political story for purely political sake. And exactly. And he essentially said, I'm going to take my money back and stop giving you money. I said, well, then you're going to have to do that. And
Let's now go to the third practical tool. What can we do to then take action to restore? And let's say in the next 5 years, come up with a reasonable solution to sort of restore the faith, improve the numbers. I want to see numbers come back. People come back to Mass. The numbers improve. People grow in their faith and start to recover. We can start working. It wasn't an overnight job that the church fell into its crisis. I mean, there's that perception that Vatican II caused everything. Yeah. I think that was just a catalyst, and there was an underlying problem that was building up. And
absolutely.
Came out with the culture as well, got swept up. But my vision is that in the next 5 years, we can achieve. I mean, I like to think in terms of like a project management mindset. We have a goal. We need to achieve it. And I think that's how we need to think. We need to think in terms of being practical, being reasonable, and being rooted in reality. I mean, we need to take action. That's why I love the work you're doing. And that's why, we're doing here at the Catholic Toolbox podcast. We're also a radio show. So please enlighten us. What's a third practical tip that we can do, take action now to start helping the renewal of the church as the church militant on earth? We are fighting sin. We are fighting evil in order to achieve our homeland, which is heaven. So what can we do as a third practical tip to take action now?
You got to kick butt and take no prisoners. No, I'm serious. I mean, you have to confront. This is why you have to be spiritually grounded and intellectually absorbed.
And you're preparing us, Michael. You're preparing us for the
You got to go to battle. You have got to go to battle. You got to go either pray in front of abortion clinics. And, we did that here on 2-3 weeks. I don't remember what it was, 3 or 4 weekends ago, whenever it was. Yeah. We hadn't even barely had our rosaries out. Some guy comes jogging through. He recognized one of the guy's church militant jackets. And he turns around and starts F-bombing us and calling us terrorists. And, you guys suck. And then a car stopped and, said, hey, you guys aren't supposed to be in a big, large group, social distancing. And he yells, these guys are those terrorists, that Catholic, blah, 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 blah. And then he starts yelling at us and all that. You got to be, and I don't mean go to war, like become violent. I don't mean that. But I mean, you got to stand in the breach and duke it out. And, there's this sort of fanciful, romantic, nostalgic kind of thing about, go out and save the world and, let's confront. And well, how can you do that if you're not willing to do that, like with your own family members, you're a little crazy. Where are the people that you're actually going to go evangelize if the ones who are closest to you, you won't even try it with them because you're getting it, they'll get upset and whatever, or you won't try it with your friends. I'm telling you, you got to be willing to lose everything. You've got to be willing to lose everything. If you hold on to something, that becomes the tool which Satan can use to manipulate you. You have to be. We wrap up our morning prayer with the prayer to humility. You have to be able to be willing. Necessarily it's going to happen. You don't know if it is or not, but you have to be willing to lose human respect. You have to be willing to lose fortune for everything. You've got to be willing to lose it all for the sake of the kingdom. That's friendships, that's respect, that's everything. It's a frightening prospect, but I mean, you got to be willing to be martyred. You've got to be willing to be martyred. And if you don't do that, and how do you get martyred? You don't get martyred by standing back in the corner and going, well, I kind of believe in Jesus, but if you want to believe in Buddha, well, I wish you wouldn't, but that's okay. Why do you think all of the apostles were martyred? And, you know, John was, and, you know, John wasn't martyred, but he probably at some point wished he had been. I mean, you know, they tried like three different times to kill him and torture him and stuff. It didn't work. So they threw him on an island and die of old age in a cave. And this was the fate of the apostles. I mean, look at a crucifix. If you aren't willing to do that, to get out and fight, if you've got, you know, you're obviously younger, you probably have younger listeners, you know, when they're in college or university. I mean, look what the left did. What did the Marxist left do to gain control of the world? They confronted and they stormed out, you know, they raid college campuses and, you know.
And they didn't do it for 5 years. They did it for how long?
For a century.
A century, essentially.
I mean, oh, yeah, yeah. They introduced contraception into the mindset so they could break down the sexual morals.
Slowly,
it's, you know, you got to be able to stand up and say, wrong, absolutely wrong, wrong. That's wrong. And
that doing charity. I mean, I think when you explain.
I don't mean you call the guy a jerk in the process, although sometimes exactly. That fits.
That's why people misunderstand you. That's why people misunderstand you because they think, oh, you're saying these things and you expect us to go out and sort of scream in people's faces, be what you call it.
But no.
Really, what you're saying is, in principle, that we need to take action. We need to be, but then how do we practically do it? We do it in charity, as 1 Peter 3:15 says. We state our respectfully our views, and then we fight for it. We don't compromise it, and we do it respectfully. And sometimes trying to keep a friendship going in order to win the person, because we don't want to just win arguments. We don't want to win arguments when we're
no
dealing with people. We want to win souls, and being their friend. I in my experience personally, being a friend to somebody and showing that respect, even though I disagree. The views are clear, and I'm trying to substantiate with some evidence. I mean, that's the best way to go about things. And
yeah, you don't have to be the one who worries about turning someone's friendship away. That sort of just happens. They stop calling you, you know, but a group of them go out and they do their thing or whatever. Yeah. You know, this time or maybe another time they forget to call you, and then, you know, two or three more times later they forget two or three more times, and all of a sudden, you know, just gone. And you know, you can't let those kinds of things bother you. I mean, I've said it 1,000 times. I mean, in this business, the news business we have here, that we do this on a daily basis, you got to have a thick skin. People call you every name under the sun. Who cares? But when you're talking, I mean, what we talk about in the news stories, I mean, we're not sitting here doing, hey, here's the latest economic numbers and the weather's going to be 40 degrees. That's not what the news we do here. We do news that impacts people's knowledge base so they can firm up and understand, get a firmer grasp of the culture and the forces at play and how they're playing to smarten them up. So when they go to whatever the confrontation is, and again, not some violent screaming in people's faces, but the intellectual confrontation that must take place. It must take place. This idea of, oh, I'm just going to sit back and be kind of quiet. And you know, I'm sorry. There is never a time in any of the church's history, we're just going, oh, well, that's okay. It was fine. It was never the case. Absolutely.
What did Pope St. Pius X say? Pope St. Pius X, the evil in the world is due to
lukewarm Catholics.
Is due to lukewarm Catholics.
Yeah.
That's pretty powerful. If you actually dissect and think about it, the fact that we're not out there fighting for life, fighting for restoring the faith, our cowardice, our lagging, as the light, if we believe as a church, we're the light of the world, as our Lord says, then shouldn't we naturally be out there changing the world? If we can't rely on everybody else in the world, our Lord has placed us specifically to be the light to the world, and we need to be.
It's our responsibility. You will be my witnesses throughout Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. Almost the last words he said.
You don't even have to go to the ends of the earth anymore, Michael. You know, it's
the ends of the earth have come to you.
It's a family member away. It's a fellow, maybe parishioner away. It could be let's say any kind of a priest who might need a good conversation. It might be. I mean, you don't really need to go far anymore. I mean,
No. You certainly don't have to get on a boat and sail halfway across the world to Australia or something and get off and do what St. Mary MacKillop did. You just turn to the person probably standing next to you in church. That person doesn't believe all the teachings of the church.
That's the unfortunate reality. So how many percent of, like, let's say, we say 8 to 12%, and I'm not even going to bother with any evidence, with statistics. I hope I'm wrong. I hope it's greater, but.
No, that's about right. I mean, Europe is roughly, Europe mass attendance is roughly 5%. Oceania's generally like call it 10%, 8 to 12. America's around 20 to 25%. But I mean, okay, so we win the
among whom race. Do they believe all the teaching? It's unfortunate that a lot of people still aren't catechized among those people who go to church. I think it's just a lot of it's a social habit, cultural.
Absolutely, habit. Absolutely. Most of it is. Most of it is. That's why you know they've had this.
And
this,
we hope we're wrong. We hope we're wrong.
You're not honestly, wrong. You're not wrong. You're not wrong. I mean, there's. Well, I mean, you can hope, but it's not a reasonable hope.
Exactly.
You know, you look, you just, you know, you can, you know, these people, you know, the people who show up, you know, for example, here you have on Palm Sunday, Easter, Christmas, you know, thousands of people come showing up in the church. You've never seen them before. You won't see them again for 6 months or a year. The priest knows that. This is what I'm talking about, for example, because this doesn't apply to just lady who have friends and family and all this stuff. It's also applies to priests talking to the congregation. A priest knows, they're not stupid. They know that, oh, look at this. There's, you know, 4,000 people here. Normally every Sunday there's 80. Well, you know that there's an enormous number of those people out there who are there just because it's Christmas, without giving it any thought beyond, oh, it's Christmas, let's go to church. And that's the end of it.
No way.
They're in a state of sin. They haven't been to confession in years. They, you know, they pay attention to God if they need something, like he's an ATM machine. Aside from that, they don't give him a thought. There's no way there aren't a huge number of people out there in that congregation. You might not be able to say that guy or that woman.
Yeah, we're not putting fingers. Yeah,
but you know of the collective, that's true. Why doesn't the priest say to them, don't come up here to receive Holy Communion if you're not in a state of grace? And let me help you go through and do an examination of conscience. You know, do you pray?
That's why we don't have to go to the ends of the earth. We can just have a conversation with our parishioners in love and in charity. We can engage our family members. I mean, the hardest thing, it's easy to say, oh, well, I'll evangelize, go out, start a radio show, podcast, you know. But if I'm not reaching out personally to family members, people that are close to me and evangelizing, it starts there. I mean, the domestic home, then the extended family, then your close friends. I mean, that's the apostolate there, and we want to take action. Look, but we've spoken
charity
about...
Charity begins at home, as they say. Charity begins
absolutely, at home. Absolutely, Michael. Absolutely. Look, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Let's now recap on the three practical tools that we can take action with.
Pray, study, kick butt. Does that help?
I think it speaks for itself. Absolutely, Michael. Thank you for equipping us with the tools for this week. Now it's time to put them into action.
If you enjoy listening to the Catholic Toolbox podcast, why not consider emailing us, thecatholictoolbox@gmail.com,
to book your next speaking event or consultation, obviously after COVID-19. So, look, check out our podcast. We also have a radio show. And you can go to the Catholic Toolbox podcast. We're on every single platform. Subscribe and follow us. And, you know, hopefully we can build a strong community. We can all work together to restoring the faith. If you like any Catholic Toolbox gear or merchandise, you can support us at spreadshirt.com/thecatholictoolbox. So be sure to subscribe and download to our podcast. And you can also re-listen to any of our episodes after this live episode here on Facebook. So thank you for tuning in to the Catholic Toolbox. And thank you, Michael Voris, for being with us this morning and your afternoon.
And yeah, our evening, it's like it's 8:30 in the morning, tomorrow morning over there. I'm talking to you in the future and you're talking in the past. Probably
there you go.
One.
You're tuning into the Catholic Toolbox, the art of practical Catholicism. I'm your host and founder, George Manasseh. Until next week, God bless, stay safe, and take action. In this era of grave spiritual crisis, it is not enough to simply know about your Catholic faith. That is why we need a Catholic toolbox to equip us with the practical skills necessary to live our Catholic faith to reach our ultimate goal, which is heaven for all eternity. Do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. Join us every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. for the Catholic Toolbox as we hand you the tools to go forth, live the faith, and change our modern world today. Live on the Voice of Charity.